or that it honors you. Father, I'm asking for a special prayer for myself. Lord, show us where to go. Show me where to take us. We give you all the glory, all the praise, all the power, all dominion in our lives. Thank you. I've actually written this message over the past month now because we've taken a break from John to do other things. Oh, now I really feel like the voice of God. Is it as loud out there as it is up here? It's really booming. I didn't know my voice was that deep. But no, we took a break from the book of John, and in a sense, I purposely took a break just before the passage that we're going to look at. And I've written this message probably five times, I think, twice last night. I kept asking, where am I supposed to take this? It was always in the same general direction, but it was the order of things, the how. First off, if you haven't been with us for a while, we've been going through the book of John. And the last time we got together, I guess if this was a TV show, we would be saying previously on, what we did was we went through the story of Lazarus. And the story of Lazarus, it begins with word gets to Jesus that Lazarus, his friend, one that, according to John, is someone that Jesus loved, a description that's only given to two people in that kind of context, Lazarus and the writer, John. The word gets to Jesus that Lazarus has fallen ill. And so Jesus, he waits to go to him, and in that process, that time, Lazarus dies. Now Jesus does go to the tomb, and when he gets there, he's met by Mary and Martha, that's Lazarus' sisters, and they blame him for the death. If you had only come sooner, surely this wouldn't have happened. And it's in that moment that Jesus weeps. And then when he's done weeping for a moment, he goes to the tomb. They open the tomb. He calls out Lazarus from the tomb. And Lazarus lives. This is a story of resurrection. This is the perfect picture of resurrection. Not a resurrection, but our resurrection. Understand this, that we as a people, we've gotten sick. We'll call it sin. And the thing is that in that sickness, that sin, sometimes we turn around and we blame God for our sickness, our sin, the circumstances that we're in. Only if you had done this differently, God. We think that in this process we're dying, but the reality is we're already dead. And then God weeps, and he comes before our tomb, and he calls us out, and we're alive again. That's resurrection. That's the call. This is something new. This is something beautiful. See, Jesus came to bring people to the life that his Father had always originally intended them to live. But see, there were those people that were around them that they were keeping them from that life. We could call them the oppressors. See, the Jewish people throughout history have made this big mistake of finding themselves oppressed. I mean, you can go all the way back to the beginning as far as Egypt. There they were oppressed. You go to the book of Judges and you see time and time again being oppressed. Fast forward to Jesus, and now you've got the Empire of Rome oppressing them. And even fast forward 2,000 years later, today, it's no different. It's Palestine. Each time an oppressor would come upon the people, they would cry out for a redeemer, a Messiah. They cried out for a person to come along that God might send somebody to fix it. Usually it was a temporary fix, because somehow, some way, they just found themselves back into it. When Jesus comes onto the scene, many thought that he came to deliver them from Rome. But the reality is he came to deliver them from themselves. He comes to deliver us from ourselves. He came to deliver us from those who might not want us to know who God is and who we are because of who he is. See, those are the oppressors. The oppressors weren't the Romans. Well, maybe politically, geographically. No, the oppressors really in the story that we see here, they're the Jewish leaders. Time and time again, they were upset with Jesus for doing the things that he did. He did a lot of things that were new. I mean, he healed on the Sabbath. He ate with sinners. He associated with the lesser. And perhaps his worst offense is that at no point in time did he ever pander to the Jewish leadership. See, and eventually all of that catches up to you. It catches up to Jesus and his ministry, and for what it's worth, it catches us up now into John chapter 11, starting at verse 45. But before I go there, this is, I think, the part that I want to deviate for a moment, give you a glimpse of where we're going with this. But I believe during the time, this passage that we're about to look at, it's very uniquely placed by John. We're going to be talking about two different churches today. And it's not just something that's happening then. It's something that happens still today. And this is the part that weighs on me the most, is that we're looking at two different churches, because it's very interesting what John does. Because you have to remember, we got to take the book of John the way the book of John was intended to be. It was intended to be read from beginning to end. There was no chapters, no verses. And what happens is you have this glorious moment, this incredible moment with Jesus raising Lazarus. And then all of a sudden, we're going to see what we're about to look at. We're going to see a group of people who are not happy with what Jesus is doing. How can you not be happy with what Jesus is doing? But they found a way. And then immediately after that, we see Jesus with a group of people who are enjoying him, enjoying what he's doing. They're enjoying a meal together. Why did John go from a happy event to a really horrible event back to a happy event? Because I think he wants us to understand that there was an old church, and now there is a new church. And I really want you to be thinking about that as we go through this morning. John chapter 11, verse 45. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had been had seen what he did. So in other words, we're talking about the guys, the people that were at the funeral. They believed in him. They saw it. They believed. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told what Jesus had done. They went and tattled on him. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered council and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs." They're not arguing the fact that he's doing these things. "If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was a high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." Now, he did not say this on his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. Jesus, therefore, no longer walked openly among the Jews. But he went from there to the region near the wilderness to a town called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. They were looking for Jesus, saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast at all?" Remember, there was a previous feast that Jesus held back for a little while. Well, is he going to come to this one? Verse 57, now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given order that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so that they might arrest him. So we have this group of people who believed, and then all of a sudden we have this group of people who apparently didn't believe. They went to the Pharisees. Like I said, they went to tattle on him. They didn't see the bigger picture of what God was doing. I mean, this bigger picture that Jesus has come to gather his children, which goes far beyond just what's happening within the Jewish leadership. There have been arguments have been made that perhaps maybe with the best of intentions those who went to the Pharisees went so that they might win the Pharisees over, but that's not the case here. What is happening is this: things were changing and they didn't like the change. The change was going to bring trouble, in particular in the area of the Romans, because if everybody starts following this guy, then it kind of looks like they're not really in charge anymore. If they don't look like they're in charge anymore, then the Romans are just going to, well, they're just going to sweep in. See, what's happening here is that there's really not a concern for the people amongst these Jewish leaders, but they're concerned about their position amongst the people. I mean, they don't dispute the fact Jesus is doing incredible things. But what they also see is they see people are following him. And if they're following him, that means they're not following them. Well, that's a problem. See, the perception is that Jesus is, if he's seen as the leader, well, okay, understand something. Jesus at no point in time showed any signs, any desire to stop the Romans. It's not why he came. He's not just some other judge. In fact, you can even say to the fact that Jesus says, I didn't come into this world to judge it. It's already been done. There's no need for somebody to carry out any of these things. It's already been done. I've come to rescue people out of it now. You could say he's just simply not the Messiah that they were looking for. Someone who would just come along and fix worldly problems. And in the midst of all this, you have this guy, this man, Caiaphas, the high priest of the year. You know, at different points in time, men held this position. It was much more of a political position than it was a religious position. A very prestigious position. But Caiaphas, I believe, is the prime example of what it means when we say something like this. When we say, what man meant for evil, God intends for good. Caiaphas is one of those people that examples that. He is not a good guy. In fact, what John is doing is he's pointing out two realities about Caiaphas. He's pointing out that he's being used by God and doesn't actually realize it. See, he's prophesying, they say. He says that he's throwing out prophecy. What he's really doing here is he's pointing out what Jesus is going to do. But he doesn't know why or how Jesus is going to do it. See, he wants Jesus dead, and he'll let Jesus die for the sake of the people as long as it just gets him out of the way. Because the best way to take care of a movement is get rid of the leader. So we'll let that happen. He didn't understand that Jesus actually came willing to die for the people to bring them closer. Caiaphas only has selfish motives here. He's being used by God, but not as a willing servant. And we shouldn't confuse him with, say, any of the Old Testament prophets who went out because God sent them out to declare his truth and his word. But what happens is that he still manages, he still says a few things that are going to happen. He's not like a puppet either. Don't think that perhaps that during this time God suddenly just overtook him, kind of like Balaam's donkey, and made those words come out of his mouth. No, Caiaphas had a different reason to say what he said, but God's going to do something much, much different with it. And as far as Balaam's donkey is concerned, they shouldn't be confused, although I suppose they shared some similar traits. Now, what's important to understand here, what's really going on is this. You have this group of Jewish leaders, and we'll just simply call them the old church. And they're meeting, they've been meeting through Jesus' ministry. They've been meeting over the past couple of years, over a period of 3 years. They've been meeting behind closed doors, plotting and scheming. How do we get rid of this guy? He's changing everything. But see, the time for all that's passed now. And they've come to a conclusion. They've convicted Jesus. Now it's just a matter of semantics as far as how to get rid of him. If we go back to verse 53, it says, so from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. One scholar says it this way: Jesus is not to be arrested in order to be tried. He is to be tried because he has already been found guilty. My sermon title is Lemons and Grapes, and we'll We'll get into the grapes part in a little bit, but the lemons, you've heard the phrase, right? When life gives you lemons, make lemonade. And not to compare this incredible moment in history with just simply hardships and overcoming them. That's usually what the lemon lemonade thing is, but it really is this idea that there's a bunch of lemon happening here, and God's going to make something very, very sweet out of it. Let me put it this way. They thought they were doing their plan, their idea, which was about as sour as a lemon gets. Yet they were simply fulfilling God's plan already, which is really ironic if you stop and think about it. And I'm pretty confident that when John put it in here, he was laughing when he put it in here. Because these men, they were supposed to know their Old Testament. Somewhere along the line, you would think one of them would have woke up and said, wait a minute, I think I read this was going to happen. I'm that guy. I'm not the good guy anymore. I'm the bad guy now. Now, understand, just because it was part of God's plan, the way they went about it, it doesn't say, well, I guess it was a good thing then that they went ahead and did it. No, it's still an evil thing. God may use it. God did use it. It was still an evil thing. It really, in a lot of ways, this whole picture, it goes back to the judges and the time of the judges. And I love the book of Judges. And it's interesting because you got a variety of judges over a period of time. And virtually every judge's story begins with this. Once again, the Israelites did evil in the sight of the Lord. Literal translation, once again, they spit in God's face. Once again, they did it in front of him. They didn't even try to hide it, is what the writer is saying. How many times do you rescue a people that do that? How many times? I mean, if I was God, how many times would I have given up on them? Jesus is a case of he didn't give up. But eventually there is a cutoff. And that's really what Jesus' ministry is. It's the cutoff point. It's get on board or don't now. The sad truth is this very same thing that's happening then happens. Well, it happens today, and it happens today in churches all across the country. And I suppose it even happens outside of the church to a certain extent. I mean, let's face it, people generally don't like change. They don't like the idea of something perhaps becoming not the way it was. And so you get a people who don't like change. You get a people that they don't like how something perhaps is being done. They think that perhaps there is a traditional way, and that traditional way is the only way to do it. The funny part to that is that keep in mind that most traditions usually at some point in time were something new that replaced a previous tradition. And so when these traditions get broken and something new comes along, they might meet in secret places, behind closed doors. They grumble and they complain, never directly to the people that it actually is dealing with. And again, they don't think people know. Stop for a moment here. Why is this story in the book of John? How did John, was John in on this meeting? How did he know it was happening? They thought they were doing it in secret. Whatever a man thinks he does in secret, God reveals. So this group of people, they grumble and they complain and they think they're doing it so well hidden. And they, in that meeting, place a judgment. This is how it will be dealt with. And they just look for a way to justify it or to carry it out. I'm going to get personal for a moment here. Because see, this area happens a lot within the pastoral ministry especially. It's happened in my life. It's happened in many friends. I have many friends that are in ministry. You get this group of people, we call it the church. And somewhere along the line, perhaps within a church decides that the church is theirs. That is to say that it's not God's. And the church will be done a certain way. You could even say that it's being done in their image. And so what this church will do then is they will bring a pastor on board. The pastor, the idea that he would do church the way they want. But see, we have to understand what a pastor is and what a pastor's called to do. A pastor is a shepherd. A shepherd is a leader, not a follower. So eventually, in the process of leading, something will get done differently. So when this happens, they get rid of him. Usually this happens behind closed doors and quiet little meetings. Every pastor I know who has gone through this, and the only pastors I know that haven't gone through this are pastors that are still in their first church. It never comes as a surprise. Just like John, they knew what was going on. And then somewhere in all the big process, they'll justify it, and they'll even give it a really nice spiritual reason as to why they're doing it. I'll give you some statistics. Just over 2/3 of pastors that are fired from ministry were fired on non-sin related issues. You would think that the number one reason why a pastor would be fired from a church was because he fell into sin, and some sort of sin that perhaps even wasn't even he wasn't going to be repentant of, or something to that effect. You would think, but it's less than 1/3 pastors that are fired under that situation. It's a shame that any are. But less than 1/3, over 2/3 of them were fired for what most people sum up as irreconcilable differences. This is divorce talk. And for a building that's supposed to not believe in divorce, there are a lot of churches that are divorcing their pastors. And somewhere they cap it off, and they love to use the words, "It must be God's will." See, the pastor, he will leave the situation and he'll leave with his chin held high. And he'll say something to the effect of, "I think it's just God's will that I move on." Sounds good. Do God's will. That's good. And maybe there's some truth in there. But it's not necessarily believed. And the people who caused all of this turmoil in his life, they will say it too. It's God's will that he moves on. God has something better for him, just not here. In fact, most pastors, I use the word fired. You know that most pastors aren't ever fired. They just find a way to move on. It looks nicer on the resume. And they usually move on because life has been made so miserable that there's irreconcilable differences. The average lifespan, or I should say ministry span, of a pastor right now currently in the United States is just under 5 years, serving in a pulpit for just under 5 years. In the youth ministry, they say 18 months, although many point more towards somewhere between 9 and 12, not even a whole school year. Now, going back to the pastor, here's something interesting. I wasn't sure how to approach these numbers with you. I could ask you, we could take a quiz real quick. Who do you think has a longer tenure, those in rural areas or those in urban areas? Because in rural areas, the pastor's lifespan, and by the way, we're rural, just in case you didn't know, it's under 3 years. In the urban area, 12. Why do you suppose that is? Why do you suppose the lifespan of a country pastor, and keep in mind, I've been in nothing but rural churches really for 20 years. Why do you suppose that this is? What? And maybe the statistics we need to look at are not so much that, but look at the attendance of the churches. Because here's the statistics for church hopping, okay? In urban churches, the average person stays in a church less than 3 years. They commit to a church for less than 3 years. And in a rural church, the average person stays in a church for 20 plus years. Are we seeing any connections yet? So the difference is perhaps maybe it's founded in choices and traditions. In the urban setting, if you don't like it, well, it's kind of like restaurants. They're all over the place. I'll just go to another one. But in the rural setting, it would seem that if you don't like it, well, you get rid of the pastor. It's easier. I like my spot in my pew. Now, I suppose you could say that there's something good to say about longevity in rural churches, and that is good. That's really a nice statistic to say, hey, we've got longevity in churches, but we don't have it necessarily with pastors. And it's not just pastors, but it's leadership in general. So we do have to ask this question, why is there this turning over a pastor so frequently? Now, real quick, if you're wondering, because I know you are, well, what about here at SIO? Well, what's our stats? Now, it's kind of a tricky thing for us. Now, we were created, this church has a history over 150 years. Started with a man by the name of Joab Powell. Joab was a circuit rider, so he was here occasionally. Okay, to call him the pastor, that might be stretching it. He was a preacher. Okay, from what I understand, a very powerful preacher, but he was a preacher. And he loved to spread the gospel. He was a missionary. Okay, so and he preached here, and then he preached out where we call, you know, the Vineyard Church. You know, he preached out there, and he preached all over the place. Horseback preacher. But see, for us here, I think the real time to really honestly start focusing is 1932. Because see, in 1932, from what I understand based on church records, SIO Baptist got its first full-time pastor. Up to that point, we shared pastors. We shared church buildings. There was like, we were all over the place. In fact, I mean, even here, for those who know, this is, we're, what, 30 years now into this place? Is that right? 20 years? Somewhere in that, right? So, but 1932 was the first full-time pastor at SIO Baptist Church. So not counting me, take me out of the equation for a moment. 1932 to 2009, full-time pastors. There have been 12 of them. This is not counting associates, because in many cases, the associates became the pastors. Which that's a whole other messy thing. 12 pastors, 1932-2009. That puts us at an average of a pastor every 6.5 years. And I know that the previous pastor here was 9. So that means there's somebody here who is a whole lot shorter than 6. Actually, there's a couple of them. Go back to John. I think there's a lesson that we need to learn here from John, what John is really revealing to us. See, the reality is this. We like the things the way we like things to be. That's human nature. We don't like disruption. We don't want to jeopardize being comfortable. And quite frankly, as the church, we're no different than the Jewish leaders 2,000 years ago. Jesus comes and he shakes things up and he does things very differently. In fact, you could almost make an argument that it would seem that Jesus was absolutely opposed to the Old Testament. He healed and worked on the Sabbath. He ate with the unclean and he touched them too. Even at the Last Supper, he breaks tradition by breaking bread. But see, what he's doing is it's not opposed to the Old Testament. He's breaking man's traditions. Not God's word. Do you understand something? I don't know how comfortable this will make you feel, but to somebody who is a committed, involved, serving Jew, they are Jewish not by birth, they're not Jewish by, in a sense, a race, but they are practicing Jewish. Judaism, okay? Our foundation. Do you understand that they look at us, the Christian church, as a cult? A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people don't get that. We follow a false teacher, according to them. I don't know if you paid attention to the Democratic Party and their whole convention a few weeks back. And something happened in that whole entire process. It was kind of a weird thing, but they dropped a few things from their platform. Quite frankly, I didn't know they had a platform, but they have a platform, and they dropped God out of it, Okay, oh, big surprise. So they dropped God out of it, but they also dropped, and this is the one I really didn't understand at all, but they dropped Jerusalem as being the capital, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Part of me is like, what does that even have to do with the Democratic platform? I'm not sure, but somehow they managed to get rid of it, right? Without anybody knowing, but in a day of Facebook and Twitter and everything else, it got wind. So they tried to slide it back in, but they couldn't just slide it back in. They had to vote it back in. And if you saw or heard the audio clips, you know that they tried to take the vote three times. And eventually they just kind of, oh, it passed. It didn't, but they made it pass. But here's the thing, though. They interviewed, I was watching this one interview, and they interviewed one of the delegates, happens to be a mayor of a town that has got a very large Jewish population. And he made the comments that the only reason that America is even interested, has any interest whatsoever in Jerusalem and in Israel and all of those things, the only reason is because of the Christians that are pushing their agenda. He says this right on the news. They're pushing their agenda because they want to see us either convert or be slaughtered to hasten the coming of their God. That's how we're looked at as a church, because Jesus did things differently. Breaking tradition, it's a scary thing. There are a few phrases that hate. I can't stand. In my top two, it's always been done this way. I hate that phrase. Because it's an untrue statement. Now, it may be very true that it's the way you've always known it, but there's a really good chance that always wasn't always. I want to give some examples. How the church treats hymns, for instance. It's an interesting thing. There are many people who have taken hymns as a whole. By the way, I want to make sure you understand that I love hymns. I love the history in the songs that we find in the hymns. But there are some people who have elevated hymns to almost biblical status. Like, it's just as equally of important as a book. I've seen people get their theology out of hymns before they get it out of here. And I'll be honest, there's a few hymns, not the place to get your theology. Just because it rhymes doesn't make it true. But here's the thing. Do you realize that at one point in time, the songs that are in the hymnal weren't hymns? They were simply songs that were being distributed to the churches? Somewhere along the line, somebody then turned around and put them in a book. And in some cases, the hymns that we have, if you look at the dates, you're like, oh, wait, this hymn was written in this date, but the music came way later. But we'll call it the hymn as the whole thing. But no, it's what about, I mean, it was a poem to begin with. Wasn't even meant to be sung in some cases. But somebody modified it. They took it and they made it their own. We do that here every now and then. But then somebody says, but that's not how the hymn was. That's okay. That's not how the writer had it. It's a funny thing because these songs, they get added to the book. This summer I was at a church down on the coast, and they had brand new, what looked like brand new pews in their brand new hymnals in their pews. And I love looking through hymnals. Okay, my first question is, okay, where's Holy, Holy, Holy? Because if it's not in there, it's not real. You know, Chuck, that's my tradition. Okay, no, so I'm flipping through it and it's brand new, but we sang a lot of songs, right? We sang a couple hymns. Never once picked up the hymnal. Okay, they had it all on the screen. They were a small church and all the songs were very, very traditional songs, but we never actually used the hymnal, which I thought was weird because they have all these beautiful brand new hymns, and I opened it up and it creaked, right? And so I'm flipping through it though, but here's what I found. This is the beauty of it. I was going through it and all of a sudden I started recognizing certain songs. See, these songs, they were written in the late 70s, early 80s. They were songs that we were singing in church when I was in high school. I was in high school in the mid 80s. And so we would sing these songs, but we would sing them, they were known as choruses. In fact, they were what caused quite the commotion in the church because they weren't the hymns. And the way they would be sung, this is how you knew that you were going into a whole different area of music, because suddenly the overhead got turned on. You remember the overhead, right? We didn't have projectors, right? We had that overhead with that very dim bulb, right? And then you'd have the guy who had to sit up there and put the transparency up there, right? And he put it in upside down, and then he tried to fix it by flipping it reversed, and it's like, you know, and his hand was always in the way. Now, if you were super high tech, and we were very high tech in Portland, you tape them together and put them on the reel, right? And then you just scroll them like a teleprompter, you know? And then there's one in the middle that was upside down, but there's nothing you can do about it now. Just keep going. But these songs were now in the hymnal. And I'm like, so does that make them official? I was like, is this like canonization for songs? I mean, have they become, they've made it, they've arrived. Will it be that the songs that we sing today as choruses, the praise and worship songs that perhaps you hear on K-Love, that in future church will be the hymns? And there will be people like, I'm seeing Mickey laughing there, but will it be Mickey complaining because she's 60 years old going, we don't sing the classics. We don't sing like all the ones that we just got done singing. Now, understand that the hymns, they have a wonderful, rich history, and especially a rich history within our own culture here. One of my favorite hymn writers is Fanny Crosby. She wrote Blessed Assurance, To God Be the Glory. And if you know her story, she was blind, which makes the things that she says that much more incredible. So there's a passion in her. But see, Fanny also wrote a lot of secular poems, poems that had nothing to do with God. She wasn't just a hymn writer. Now, the height of her hymn writing was in the 1850s. And during that time, she was part of what was called the Holiness Movement. Today, we would equate them to very charismatic. And it was because of that movement and a few other things. Did you know that many of her hymns were banned in churches? In fact, I read one where it was they didn't want to sing her songs because she was blind. And there was a question of who sinned first. Now, we wouldn't ever think of that with Fanny Crosby today. We would sing Blessed Assurance gladly. There was a time, though, when many hymns, not just Fanny Crosby, but many hymns were actually tossed out. Churches had hymn-burning parties because they wanted to get rid of them because they felt suddenly they became the devil's music. In fact, in particular, there was one reason for this. It was because of the music that went with them. They were using the devil's instrument. You know the one I'm talking about, that evil instrument, the piano. Churches were burning their pianos. Organs were okay, as long as there were pipes. But the piano was evil. You know why the piano got turned evil? It's because the piano was being heard coming out of the bars. And since the world was using it, we can't. In fact, there are many churches today that still will not use instruments because of that very reason. What God intended for good, man turned to evil. And we've lost the art of music for some. Previous church we were at, we had transitioned from, we had a very small sanctuary. In fact, I think our sanctuary was about this big, with an aisle in the middle. And we had two services. And we got to the point where we realized that people were coming to the same church, meeting each other at Walmart, and saying, what church do you go to? We thought we had an incident like that here, but I mean, they legitimately never saw each other. They never passed each other. You know, so they had no clue. So we had a gym, so we decided, well, let's meet in the gym. We would do it once in a while for like Christmas or something, but we permanently moved out into the gym, got chairs. Well, in that process, we also decided we're going to go to screens because it was more convenient. The chairs that we got didn't have a place to put hymnals. So the hymnal stayed in the old sanctuary. We just put the words on the screen. No big deal, right? You would think it was no big deal. I remember one particular Sunday, a man came up, and I kind of got in the middle of the conversation, but kind of trapped in the middle of the conversation. He was complaining that ever since we've moved out to the gym, we just don't sing the hymns anymore. Now, the funny thing is that very morning, 3 out of 5 songs were hymns, and they were sung traditionally. Keep in mind, we didn't have big worship band. We had 3 women and a piano, just like that. That's what we had. 3 hymns out of 5. And when we pointed that out, he said, well, if they're on the screen and not in a book, and I kid you not, they don't count. Now, We do hymns here. We do them, some, maybe we do not enough hymns. I don't know. I don't know what the right quotient of hymns are. I know that sometimes we do hymns differently than the way they're written. And I'm going to confess for a moment. There was a moment where I got on Adam's case because I had requested a hymn. And then I came to practice. And he did the hymn wrong. He was doing it a way that I'm like, I never heard that hymn done that way. And I got, don't you do that to that hymn. You play it this way. And I got on him about it. But see, he wasn't like defying me. That's how he knew the song. I knew the song differently. We're both right. I was definitely wrong in telling him he was wrong. It's funny when we hold on to traditions and we really don't even know where some of those traditions even come from. And sometimes when it all comes down to it, get away from the hymns for right now, that sometimes when we come to something, we see something happening, we say, oh, that's new. It's really not new at all. In fact, if we look at everything Jesus did, nothing was new in the sense it was the way it was supposed to be. It was just directing us back to the most excellent of ways that we see in Genesis. Here, communion has been that thing. We've transitioned communion in a few different ways. And I believe what we've done, I believe I have been led by the Lord to do. I have been very convicted over the issue of communion. So the transition that we made, and I want to explain it because I think, you know, maybe perhaps there are some that still don't quite understand why it is we do what we do. So some of the changes that we've made, and if you're brand new to us, welcome, and you get to, you don't have to worry about the tradition part. I envy you. We use real bread. We have it always available weekly. And we do it responsive. Why? First, we look at the disciples. And we look at Jesus. And he brings this before, in fact, you know, in biblically in John, a week from now, real time for us, months from now, we will be seeing Jesus institute communion for the first time. It's new, but it's not new. And he does this by breaking bread. It's a new covenant. And he says these very, very specific instructions. Do it once a month. No. He says, whenever we get together. Whenever. Translation? Always. He breaks bread, not crackers. I don't understand, and I don't know who ever got the idea that little styrofoam Pez-shaped pieces of whatever that is was bread. I don't know where that came from, and I want to go find the company, and I want to go, you know, there's companies that should go bankrupt. It should be the styrofoam Pez bread people, right? I don't understand the purpose. That stuff, people joke about Twinkies and shelf life. I'm sure that a church that has some of that stuff, they probably bought a case of it 150 years ago. I mean, it's just that it stuff does not go bad because there's nothing real in it. I do question whether it honestly is styrofoam. I think it is. But and we haven't used those here. We got into using oyster crackers, right, for a while, salty oyster crackers, which sometimes there was more salt in there than there was juice in the cup to come. But I don't understand where we got that idea. Now, Jesus, he specifically at that moment, and while he's talking about Judas, but he makes the comment, he says that who dips in this bowl with me, which indicates what? They're dipping the bread. This was traditional. That's what they did. It wasn't just communion. It was just the meal in general. I mean, the bread was very dense. It's usually very thick, especially at Passover time, no yeast. And so you soften the bread up by dipping it in the wine. That's what you did. It's also a way not to get drunk, but enjoy the wine. It served multiple purposes. But they dipped. I do understand that the cup itself is a very important element to communion. The cup is all throughout the scripture, and it has its reasoning. So it could be a cup and it can be a bowl, but we do see this picture of dipping. But if if we think about what is traditional in a church, and this is, we are not exclusive to this. Every church I've been in at some point in time, this is the way it's done. That they bring out this tray, and they've got micro bread, and they've got a micro cup. And I feel that somehow, some way, and I just got really convicted over this, that we've reduced communion to some sort of inconvenient yet necessary function of the church. And we do it once a month so we can get it out of the way. That's called ritual. It was intended to be relational. Quite frankly, I still don't think we, and when I say we, I say I, don't take communion serious enough. But I do believe that at certain points it's been elevated as some sort of religious act. Jesus says to do it whenever you come together. He wasn't talking about just in church service either. Whenever. He meant over meals. That's where they were at. It was a celebrated thing to do in the early church. It was the highlight of the meal, was remembering him. They wouldn't have the meal without it. The bread, the cup, they were always there at every meal. They were there every meal before, but now they had purpose every meal after. There was a double meaning to it, right? The bread of life, which we look at the manna in the wilderness, but Jesus says, I am the bread of life. With me, you won't hunger. The cup, the cup that overflows, the cup that no one will ever thirst again from, the water that came in the wilderness, the fruit of the vine. Jesus says, I am the vine. It's a reminder of who Jesus is and what he has done. And yet we have reduced it to little elements every 30 days. Can you imagine not eating or meeting but once every 30 days? There's a double meaning, a dual purpose. In fact, John spends a lot of time throughout the scripture. He points out, Jesus said this, but this is what's really going on. He does it all the time. What's interesting in John's gospel compared to the others is that at no point in time does John ever record any of the parables. But that's how Jesus taught. Jesus taught by saying a story, but he was actually painting a picture for the audience. It was always a double meaning to it, a dual purpose to it. I think that must have rubbed off on John, because if you look at the gospel of John, it's almost as if it's written as one large parable, but yet using non-parable elements, using the facts. This is what Jesus said. This is what he was doing. And if you go through all the parables, they all have that same theme. There's usually a good guy, bad guy scenario. Somebody who got it right and somebody who got it wrong. And more often than not, he's in the middle of teaching a bunch of sinners with a bunch of religious leaders sneering at him over in the corner. And he happens to tell a story about how this guy did it right and this guy did it wrong. And it's almost as if Jesus was to say, you guys have the opportunity to do it right. They haven't. And they won't. Look at the prodigal son. There are two sons in that story. We always focus on the one, the redemption. It's a beautiful story. But there's a second son in that. That second son, he's upset at the end of the story. He's done everything the way it says to do it. How come he doesn't get the party? And yet the father says, no, the party's for all of us. And I don't want to celebrate it with him, not that son of yours. In fact, that parable's found in the middle of a bunch of parables that the religious leaders were pointing out that Jesus wasn't following tradition. Luke 15, it says, now tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled. This man receives sinners and eats with them. Translation, we don't do that. That's not what we are to do. So then Jesus goes into a series of parables of what we are to do. John points out in this moment that Jesus raises Lazarus, this event happens, and Jesus moves on, moving away from any traditions. And it says that he doesn't even engage the public ultimately anymore, specifically not engaging the Jewish leaders. See, they were given a chance to join, given a chance to follow. And some did out of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Some did believe. Some would come to believe later. But many didn't, because they didn't want to embrace any change. So what Jesus did was, there were two churches. There was the church of the way it always was, and the church of the way it always should have been. And he has this church and this change would become what we say is the gospel. It's kingdom come. It's the change in how we do things and why we do it. In fact, if you go into John chapter 12, it says, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they gave a dinner for him there. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those reclining with him at the table. Oh, I wish to have been at that table. The smile that had to have been all over Lazarus' face. He can honestly say at that table, I was once dead, but now I'm alive. Jesus is there, and he is what? He is eating with them. He is celebrating with them. It would be a week from this moment that he would then take the bread and take the cup and say, this is my body. You don't get it right this very second, but you're going to. This is my body. This is my blood, and it's for you. This church, this is this table that they are sitting at and laughing at and enjoying one another at and being served at. This table is the beginning of what we would call the early church. This is the way it's meant to be. And I don't think it's an accident that John happened to put these two opposing churches next to each other in his gospel. It's just like at the beginning. There are two people groups. Those who believed and those who went and told. We go back to communion. Whenever you get together. Communion is supposed to be done in community. Not just passed out, but to participate. And community is meant to meet more than once a week. It's one of the reasons why we do the whole small group thing. The small group is just one extra avenue to understand that church doesn't just happen Sunday morning between 10:30 and, I know, It's not enough just to get together once. It's not enough to get together twice. How many days are in the week? How many days can you celebrate the church? How many days can you get together and remember who Jesus is and what he has done? In fact, the Bible, if you look at it, it says that we're supposed to get together for one another, to lift one another up. In fact, do a search sometime for the words one another. You'd be amazed at all the things that we're supposed to do with one another. And part of that's going back to the table. And I am wrapping up here. See, the table is an important symbol in the church. I mentioned the prodigal son. The story ends with an invitation to the table. The feast is on. They brought the best of the best. They slaughtered the fatted calf, right? It is a monster celebration. It is a party at the table. And they're bringing them in. And the story should end with everybody at the table. But it doesn't. It ends. It ends with a guy sitting on the porch pouting. Because he never got that, and he followed all the rules. He did what he thought he was supposed to do, and he doesn't get the feast. And the reality is, you do get the feast. The Father's inviting him into the feast, and he's choosing to stay there. The old church is choosing to stay there. Life is happening over here, and they're choosing to live in death, is what Jesus is teaching. I think when it comes to this meal, this feast, coming to the table, breaking bread with one another, I mean, it should be this picture of heaven. And I understand, I love my family. My dad is going to be listening to this, and I'm going to get a text tomorrow morning. I don't remember any particular time where Thanksgiving truly was a picture of heaven. I'm hoping that's not heaven. Maybe some of it, but not all of it. But that's what it, we're supposed to gather around the table, because that's heaven. It's coming to the table that he has set before us. You guys know the song, right? There's a save a place for me at the table, right? And this is what it's supposed to be. But I think even the meal, getting together, eating, celebrating with one another, we've reduced it just like we've reduced communion. We call it potluck. It's like saying, now track with me for a moment. I know right now some of you are like, there's a potluck. Potluck, that word, what does that mean? It sounds like you just never know what you're going to get, which is usually true. It means joy. Now, some of you might like that kind of surprise when it comes to your food, and I appreciate you. I am a picky eater. I am not that person. Potluck is scary. But the idea behind the meal is not. It's a family meal, is what it's supposed to be. It's what it needs to be. It's what it can be. It's a chance to come together and break bread. Now, if I can speak on behalf of tradition for a moment. The traditional early church, it was a time for them to bring their best to the table, to share with one another. That's what the meal was, to bring their best. It was a new expression of the feasts, such as Passover. They put thought into it. I don't mean to ruffle a feather, but they didn't just run down to the corner store and grab a bag of chips. They thought about the meal, about blessing somebody with the meal. To bring your best, this really should mean some sort of sacrifice involved. In fact, it's what happens next in John chapter 12. We see Mary come, and we'll talk about this next week, but Mary comes, and she has a very expensive bottle of ointment, perfume, and she blesses Jesus with. She brings her best to the table. And considering, in fact, when it comes to the sacrifices, we don't sacrifice the same way anymore. This is a different expression of that sacrifice. That you bring your best to bless others with. So where am I going with it? I'm saying this. That next week, we are not going to have a potluck. We're going to have a family meal. I'm inviting you to come to the tables and enjoy a meal, intentionally setting aside time after the service. I might even try to get done early for it. But that we might come to the table and enjoy, and everybody would bring their best. And we're going to celebrate around the table the way it should be. We're going to make it a family meal. It's not going to be. Do you understand that there are some people just simply, and I'm not talking about myself, there are some people who will not go to a church potluck because they've had a bad experience at a church potluck. I know that sounds weird, but they have. So they stay away from it. It's not something younger people really enjoy in general. So let's make it something enjoyable. Let's make it the event that it's supposed to be, the celebration that it can be. I know for some of you, you look at potluck as in general and say, well, that's what it is. Oh, great, share that with the rest of us now. Show us why this is special. Be a part of something special. Don't just plan to come and barrel through the line, grab your drumstick and your potato salad or whatever it is that you might grab and then get out of here as quick as possible. But actually come with the plan to sit for a while, talk for a while. So next week, you bring your best. Family meal. And yes, I am fully aware that for some of you, and I do not say this in joking at all, for some of you, your best is the casserole. And your best is the meatloaf. I have been told there is a meatloaf within our midst that is the best meatloaf in the world. And so perhaps your best is the meatloaf. And perhaps your best is something where you've decided there are certain foods that just need to be mixed together, okay, and not separated evenly on a plate. And that's your best. And I'm telling you right now, bring those. Bring those. Now, I mentioned my sermon title was Lemons and Grapes. We talked about the lemons. Lemons and lemonades, right? Now, there's dual purpose here, too. See, lemons are sour. But that's what makes turning them into lemonade such a sweet, sweet thing. But what happens when something that is starts out sweet, like a grape, goes sour? There's no use for them anymore. John 15, Jesus starts talking about, I am the vine. He starts talking about what belongs on the vine and what doesn't belong on the vine. There's no room on the vine for sour grapes. In fact, it's sour wine that's offered to Jesus on the cross. So I close with a simple challenge. Be a lemon being made into lemonade. That even on your worst day, you are still Christ in you. Be a lemon being made into lemonade. Don't be a grape gone sour. Life's too short for it. Let's pray. Father God, we do thank you so much for this time. And Father, we ask that this church would be a church that glorifies you. Father, we ask that all that we do, whether it's tradition or new, that, Lord, that the only reason that we might ever do it, that we might ever sing it, that we might ever preach it, is to glorify you. And that those that might hear might believe. Let us never deviate from that. And Father, I especially pray for myself, as I know that there are those in this church that pray for me daily in the same way. Lord, never let me get comfortable with a position. Father, I do pray that this church would be a church that has a cup overrunning with lemonade. Lord, go before us today. Give us the day that you have for us. Give us the rest tonight that we might take on the week that you have for us. And that, Father, that we might intentionally intertwine with one another. Lord, intervene if necessary, that we might grow together as your church. We give you all the praise, all the glory, all the power, all the dominion. Amen.